Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us on Lit Radio Podcast. I'm Teja. Today, we are joined by Michael Stanford to talk about his book, Leadership Transition: How Leaders Turn Chaos into Growth. Michael is the founder and managing director of Summit Leadership, a boutique leadership development organization which supports leaders and their organizations through significant change. He was the head of the transformational leadership practice, EMEA, at Korn Ferry. Prior to that, he worked as a business leader and consultant in a leading business school. Leadership Transition is the first book to bring fresh wisdom from clinical research in post-trauma growth into the realm of leadership. It takes a careful look at what disrupts leaders most when they experience the sometimes destabilizing chaos of transitions in their work. It also explores how our minds are programmed to manage the threats and opportunities of dramatic change. Oh, hi, Mike. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio Podcast to talk about your new book, Leadership Transition. So my first question to you is why you decided to write it?
Thanks, Teja, and great to be with you today. So I decided to write Leadership Transition when I discovered that we weren't thinking about leadership transitions in the right way. Companies, organizations, and leaders themselves weren't thinking about leadership transitions in the way that some fields of psychology were thinking about them. Organizations and leaders tended to think about leadership transitions as something that they could develop some strategies and tactics to resolve. So going through a transition as a leader, if you did the right things in the right few weeks or the right few months, if you followed a script, then you are likely to be successful. And I discovered through some research I was doing, doctoral research I was doing, that, well, strategizing and putting together tactics for leadership transitions was helpful for leaders. It left untouched a way of thinking about leadership transitions that could be really, really helpful for leaders and for the organizations that they serve. And this was a part of leadership transitions that that I was able to dive into in part because I was more interested in the, let's say, the psychological dimensions of what it means to go through a transition as a human, as a leader, what it means to go through a transition, and a little less interested in the tactics of it. The tactics of it have been well written about, you know, the things you do in the first 3 months when you're going through a transition. The psychological dimensions of going through a transition, to me, were far more interesting. And that became even more interesting to me when I was conducting my doctoral research in the area. Started it about 12 years ago. And the doctoral research started kind of with an idea of continuing to examine the strategies and tactics of leadership transitions. I was going through my own leadership transition at the time, so I was my own test case in a way. But I found my own transition to be difficult in ways that weren't explained by the usual popular literature in transitions. And the more I met with executives, the more these executives would talk to me about their transitional experiences using the language of pain and struggle and difficulty and even trauma. And I thought that was really interesting. And I thought it was particularly interesting when I turned my own research towards what can we learn from post-trauma growth about how we use difficult circumstances in our life, including, for example, a leadership transition. How can we use those to explore ourselves and understand better who we are and what's meaningful for us, and to grow, to not leave it with the difficulty or the challenge or the pain, but to use that experience as a way to grow. And my research ended up being primarily on post-trauma growth and leadership transitions and what we can take from clinical work in post-trauma growth, which is a relatively new field. So that leadership transitions cannot be just something we create strategies to resolve, but they can be laboratories for our own growth. That's my practice now, and it's the doctoral research put into practice over the past 10 or 12 years. That is the subject of the book. So the book tells the story of how leaders can find growth even in their most difficult transitions.
It seems like it was a really interesting journey for you to get to write the book, which is, yeah, of course, great. But before we discuss more the content of the book, let's see how transitions impact leaders. So you say that more and more leaders, even at younger ages than in the past, face challenging changes in their work and personal lives. So how does the chaos that comes with transition impact leaders?
Yeah, we're funny creatures in a way. So we're designed. 250,000 years of evolution has designed us to deal with chaos. Chaos in our lives is inevitable, and in some ways we like it. In some ways, chaos can be an avenue, let's say, towards creativity, towards improvement, towards doing things better, to having more meaningful lives. But chaos can be overwhelming. And we can think about chaos as the unpredictable and the confusing. Those are two important dimensions of chaos. When we find ourselves in environments that are unpredictable, we don't know what's going to happen with any great confidence. And therefore, we're confused. We're confused about how things may unfold. We're confused about what to do, what's the right thing to do. It's not evident what the right thing to do is. And in that confusion is discomfort, because we like to know what's going on. We like to be able to prepare for what's going on. We like to feel secure and safe, and chaos doesn't enable us to feel secure and safe. I'd say, how does chaos impact leaders, even younger leaders who find themselves taking on important and complex and confusing roles? I think it unleashes in us a few reflexes, and one of those reflexes is quite a protective reflex. We like to protect ourselves from danger. If we're not too overwhelmed by chaos, it can be quite creative. The idea of being confused forces us to come up with answers, to create new answers. And that's a creative experience. It's a wonderful experience. Too much chaos is overwhelming. That's when burnout happens. So I was working with a leader not long ago who was in an organization he had been working in, I think, for something like 20 years. He had a promotion. He was in a new job, but the nature of that job was different than he expected. And he was working under a new CEO. New CEO brought in a new team of very senior executives, and they were kind of changing the rules of the game. And so this executive was going into a role that he expected to be one thing and was actually something else, quite something else. He expected a stable culture, and the culture was under a lot of transition. He expected that the old rules of success would be maintained through the change in CEOs. So for him, the rules of success were work hard, put your head down, get things done, do the right thing for the organization, and you'll be successful. And he started to suspect that in fact, make good presentations and say the right things was the new path to success. Now, all of this was quite confusing for him. And on top of that, he had some fairly challenging circumstances outside of work. And so he had instability and confusion and unpredictability everywhere. And that becomes very overwhelming. That's when burnout happens. And there's lots been written on burnout, on mental health, when there's a lot of confusion. But chaos can be fundamentally a creative act if it's not overwhelming our ability to cope.
Yeah, and very interestingly, in the book, you describe leadership as a journey that takes place in between the forces of chaos and forces of order. And you also discuss the benefits of each and the dangers of too much of either. So you just told us what happens when there is too much of chaos. And but now, could you tell us why we actually need it and how can we use it to help us grow and develop as leaders?
Yeah, it's such an interesting topic. It's this frame of life and leadership is something that's lived between the forces of chaos and the forces of order. It's a useful metaframe, and it's a useful metaframe because it explains in broad terms the conditions under which we evolved as a species. So humanity over a quarter of a million years has evolved in a very chaotic, often unfriendly, often difficult environment, unpredictable environment. Natural disasters and diseases and new tribes moving into our territory and the sources of food either falling to crop disease or the buffalo moving on. All of these things are ways in which chaos has presented itself to our ancestors over the years. And we've evolved to try to make order out of chaos. That's been, in some ways, the fundamental task of our species through its evolution. The environment around us is chaotic. How do we make order and predictability out of it so that we can be more certain of our survival? I find that a very, very useful meta frame. And leadership has no shortage of chaos, as any leader will tell you. Being a leader is essentially an act of dealing with chaos and trying to make order out of chaos. The funny thing about chaos and order is they're both good, and in their extremes, they're both not so good. So we may have a reflex to build order out of chaos, to build predictability when things are unpredictable. But if we do too much of that, if we're too ordered, we stagnate. If we're too ordered, we can lose our ability to deal with the inevitable chaos that life is going to throw at us. And so some chaos is really useful for keeping us exploring and creative, creating what's new, exploring what could be, because undoubtedly no matter what our efforts are to build stability in our world and predictability in our worlds, the world will throw things at us that are unpredictable and unexpected. And so how does chaos, how do we need it? I'm not sure it's so much a question of need. It's inevitable. We do need it in order to keep agile. We do need it in order to not stagnate. And there is some research that would indicate that too much order atrophies us. Too much order weakens us, even through all stages of our life. As we live through our lives and live through our leadership, too much order risks making us too comfortable, too lazy, unable to deal with the slings and arrows of life. And so the chaos does keep us active, does keep us exploring and learning and improving.
Yeah, Mike, I think that's very interesting. especially what you said about too much order could make us lazier or even weaker. So yeah, it really shows why we do need chaos at least some of the time. But now let's discuss another part of the book. So as you mentioned earlier on, leadership transition draws from evolutionary psychology, existential psychology, deaf psychology, narrative psychology, but especially the psychology of post-trauma growth.
Yeah.
So could you share with us some of the learnings from all of those fields that we can implement in dealing with leadership transitions?
With pleasure, with pleasure. I had a choice, I had an important choice to make early in my research as I was diving into the topic of how do our minds work when we're in transitional space? How are our minds designed to work when we're dealing with chaos and trying to make order out of it in the context of leadership, of course. And one choice would have been to take one school of psychology and rely on that for the answer. And I didn't do that. I chose to cast a wide net. I chose to look at different fields of psychology, in part because I found great wisdom in many different schools of psychology, some of which I left out of my thesis, some of which I've left out of the book. But I found great wisdom in four or five different schools of psychology in ways of interpreting how our minds seem to be designed to work when we're going into transitional space. And hence the five or so schools of psychology that are explained in the book. They each have their own benefit. So evolutionary psychology, for example, is based on the idea that just as our bodies have evolved to adapt well to the world outside of us so that we can survive in the world outside of us, so too have our minds. Our minds have been designed to deal with the threats of the outside world and to thrive and flourish despite those threats. I really appreciated evolutionary psychology for a couple of reasons. One is, I think it's really useful to think of our minds when we're in difficult, challenging, transitional space, to think of our minds as the product of ancient evolutionary influences. We may like to think that our brain is all prefrontal cortex and rationality and reasoning. It isn't. A lot of our brain is the more ancient part of our brain, in which we hold instincts and urges, in which we hold old programming about what to do when we're under threat. Instincts to protect, instincts to build alliances, instincts to work our way up in a hierarchy because there's more access to resources as we get higher in a hierarchy. And while we may like to think that our rational cognitive brain rules, the brain is much more than that. And evolutionary psychology does a really, really good job of helping us understand how our brains react when we're under threat or given the opportunity of a transition. Existential psychology I found really interesting because it has to do with the anxieties of human existence. To be human, according to the existential psychologists, means to be subject to some core anxieties, no matter where you live, no matter who you are. And existential psychology names four of them. It talks about the anxiety of death, the anxiety of isolation, the anxiety of choice, and the anxiety of meaninglessness. And an important dimension of existential psychology is how do we as humans apply ourselves to understanding those anxieties and overcoming them? It gives in quite subtle and important ways, it gives some indication of when we're mindful of how our behaviors, how our mindsets are dealing with those four anxieties, we're likely to come up with good answers and therefore resolve those anxieties. But we have a reflex in us to not deal with them well and to accept, let's say, insufficient answers to those anxieties. So, and organizational life and leadership has a part to play in that. So in existential psychology, they give examples of less useful ways to attempt to resolve the four anxieties. So for death, we like to feel special. The more we feel special, the more we imagine that the vagaries of life that everyone else is subject to, we're not subject to. Anything that helps us to feel special helps to mitigate this fear of death. Anything that provides us with a community mitigates our fear of isolation. Isolation is the sense of I'm in it alone. It's a truth of life. There's no other you. There's no other me. No matter how strong our communities, our social environments might be, nobody is going through your life. You're doing it alone. I'm living my life in a way that nobody else experiences, exactly how I experience it. So having a community around us provides us with isolation or mitigation of isolation. Choice, the third anxiety of existential psychology, is that we're provided with choice all through our lives. We have choices to make. And every time we choose one direction, we're not choosing another direction. And that brings anxiety with us. And a good mitigation of choice is when an environment provides us with structure and takes our choice away. And the final one, meaninglessness, is the fourth anxiety of existential psychology. Meaninglessness is the anxiety of what if there's no greater celestial meaning to our lives on earth? What if we're here for a short period of time and then we're not? And that's all there is to it. And anything that helps us feel we have meaning in our lives helps us deal with that anxiety. And we can see very well how organizational life can provide some maybe not so useful mitigation for the anxieties. When we're leaders, we feel special. Being a leader in an organization means being part of a community. Organizations provide usually pretty good frameworks within which we need to operate. And they provide us with meaning in our lives. And therefore, being part of an organization can help us deal with all of the anxieties. And it's really, really interesting to see how these anxieties play out as a leader is going through a transition. So I'll hurry through the remaining ones because I could probably spend a week on each of them, but I'll try to keep to the fundamentals. You mentioned depth psychology. Depth psychology is a psychodynamic psychology. It's the sense that our behaviors are really driven by things that are beyond our conscious awareness. I really like psychodynamic work because it explains so well the behaviors that we struggle to explain in ourselves when we're under tension, when we're under high stress or going through a transition. And the psychodynamic work, the depth psychology work would encourage us to look at where the roots of these behaviors might lie in our instincts, in our urges, in our shadows, and in the parts of ourselves that we like to keep hidden because they're maybe not so acceptable to the people around us. Depth psychology urges us to look at all of those things to understand ourselves better. I also like depth psychology because it talks about life in two halves. The first half of life is being conventionally successful, doing all the things we're expected to do to be accepted by and therefore protected by society. And the second half of life is really focused on living a life that's truer to what's essential to us and not making the compromises that we might have made in the first half of life. And I find it really interesting that often the leaders we're working with are going through their most difficult transition as they're entering into the second half of life. So we have these two raging rivers within them, the confluence of these two raging rivers of, I've got to figure out this transition as I'm trying to figure out who I really am. And those two rivers coming together provide a lot of really interesting territory for growth. And the final one, post-trauma growth, was essential. It's essential in the book. It's essential to my practice, and essential to leadership transitions, because it's a relatively new field in trauma work. And it's a field that's based on the observation that, handled correctly, even the most difficult experiences in our lives can be incredibly profound and rich opportunities for self-exploration and growth. And it was the post-trauma growth clinical research, which is only about 20 or 25 years old, that turned me towards the idea of, well, all of these people I'm talking to who are going through these really challenging transitions, a lot of them are coming through those transitions stronger, more confident, more able to shape the world around them, including their organizations, because they know who they are. They better understand their own narratives, and they better understand what's essential to them. So yeah, post-trauma growth. I think of post-transitions growth in our transitions work is absolutely critical to this idea of using our most challenging experiences to become better, to grow.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating how much we can learn from psychology about how we deal with changes and chaos. So I would encourage our listeners to read more about all of that in your book. But now, in leadership transition, you also explain about the importance of our inner narratives. So, Mike, what are those inner narratives, and why do you think they're so vital?
Yeah, I got into narrative psychology because of the post-trauma growth work. The key pivot in post-trauma growth is a narrative pivot. So the post-trauma growth clinical researchers write about the fundamental movement in growth through a difficult circumstance is going from an insufficient inner narrative to a wiser inner narrative. So using a destructive or destabilizing experience to create wiser inner narratives about who you are and about how the world works is essential. That's essentially the growth of post-trauma growth. What do we mean by trauma? What do we mean by narrative? It's a good question. And when I was diving into the narrative psychology, even the writers of narrative psychology were, let's say, quite varied in how they thought about narrative. And some of them said, look, we're not going to try to define it for you. Narrative is narrative. My sense of narrative is the story our imagination makes about an experience or about our experiences to attach meaning to it. So we have an imagination, and the role of this imagination is to create story out of our experience. And the stories it creates are important stories for our survival. So our imagination is forever creating stories about, how does the world work? How do I need to work in the world? How do I need to get along with people? What's likely to happen in the world if certain things occur? And how do I manage myself so that I survive, so that I'm safe, so that I flourish? we have our minds are narrative making machines, and we're forever making up these stories. Now, I talk about narrative and core narratives, inner narratives, especially because we have stories when we're going through transitions. We have stories about how we expect the company to behave. We have stories about how we think the board will behave, our colleagues will behave as we're going through a transition, how we should behave. We have narratives about all of those things. And when those narratives are challenged by our experiences, we struggle. In effect, the definition of trauma by the post-trauma growth clinicians is trauma is what happens when core narratives are destroyed by experience. And so we can imagine that our narrative world is our map of the world and what it is and how it works and how we need to work in the world. And when experience shows us that that map is wrong, painfully wrong in some cases, we struggle. And so a lot of the narrative work, in fact, the second half of the book is indicating what narratives are most important and what makes for a wise narrative for those four narratives, so that they're strong and explored narratives that are unlikely to be destroyed by experience. They'll keep us strong.
Absolutely. And you just mentioned about that second part of the book, which focuses on the, as you call it, the leader's compass. So you say that that compass structures our four most important inner narratives as if they were four points of an inner compass, with each compass point describing an important part of who we are and what is important to us. So now, Mike, I would like to discuss each of those four narratives, starting with the north point of the compass, which is orientation. So what do you mean by that?
What do I mean by orientation? So very quickly, before I describe orientation, the post-trauma growth research seems to indicate that four narratives are particularly important. The first one is the narrative of our orientation. I've structured them in a compass simply for the sake of ease of memory, but let's look at orientation. Think of our orientation as the north point in our compass. You could call it purpose. I prefer the idea of orientation because it implies the direction you're going in. And the narrative of our orientation is the narrative of what's really important to us in our lives. If we're a leader in transition, what's really important to me as a leader? What's the point of me? What's the point of me as a leader? What's the point of me as a leader going into a new role in new circumstances? What's the good story of the work I want to do and the impact I want to have on the people around me, on the organization? And the reason orientation is so important to give good thought to, good exploration to, is if we don't have a good sense of what's important to us, of what energizes us, what's worthy of our time, you could say. If we don't know that story for us, we're very likely to adapt somebody else's version of what's important to us rather than take on our own. And so we'll use a substitute sense of purpose, substitute sources of meaning rather than our own. And that's dangerous because it means we're letting somebody else or some other entity become the main author of the story of us. That's not a good thing. We really do need to be authors of our own story. So the narrative of our orientation is the narrative of, I'm a leader going through a transition, let's say, and there are expectations about what I need to do performance-wise. That's great. That's important. But what's the difference I really want to make? If I'm going to be thanked at the end of this chapter of my leadership, what do I want to be thanked for? How do I want things to be different? Because I've been part of the story of the organization. And therefore, what's going to give me energy to get into work every day and give me enthusiasm to go into work every day? That's the north point. That's the orientation point.
Definitely. And then the south point of the compass is our roots or our values. So why are they essential?
I love it. So if our orientation is what energizes us forward with enthusiasm, you can think of our roots as the narrative of the things that keep us stable and grounded. So I think of roots as the things for which we're most grateful, our core beliefs and our core values. So the roots within us that guide our behavior, guide our essential maps of how we want to work in the world. The if our orientation is the story of our why, the roots is the really the story of our how. It's essential because if we don't have a well-explored, well-nurtured, and deep root system that we're aware of, then we're very likely to be vulnerable to compromising things that are essential to us, to working against our beliefs. The most some of the most painful stories I hear in my practice are stories of leaders who are being asked to behave in certain ways that they find deeply uncomfortable, and they're not quite sure why. And it turns out they're being asked to become people they don't like. And in order to unpack that, it's really important to get into the core beliefs and core roots. And I say unpack and I say explore because they're worthy of exploration. When we talk about our values and beliefs, you ask any room of leaders, what are your core values? And you'll get collaboration, integrity, trust, and creativity, let's say. It's an easy list. But those aren't really often at the individual level the things that matter most. A good way to think about your beliefs and values is to remember the last time you were outraged at work or full of joy at work, and what was at play. It's very likely that some values, important values or beliefs were at play.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting part of the book. And then our relationships are the east point of the leadership compass. So, how do they help us deal with transitions more easily?
It's really, really important to understand our relational life, I guess you could say, when we're going into a transition, because our relationships are fundamental to our stability. But in leadership transitions, we focus on three relationships in particular. Your relationship with your secure bases as you're going through a transition, your relationship with the organization, and your relationship with yourself. Very, very briefly, your secure bases are the people around you who stabilize you, who challenge you, who understand you, who listen to you, and who have your best interests in mind. Having a group of those people doesn't need to be a good, a huge group, but at least a few of those people you can trust to secure you and encourage you is really, really important. Your relationship with your organization, by this we're kind of looking through a transactional analysis lens. Is your relationship with the organization a parent-child relationship? So you're a child trying to please a demanding parent, or is it an adult-to-adult relationship? So you're an adult with responsibilities and demands on the organization, and the organization is an adult with responsibilities and demands towards you. And the quality of negotiation is a negotiation of equals. That's what we're after. That's a healthier kind of relationship with the organization. So when we explore that, that relationship. That's what we're exploring. And then, of course, your relationship with yourself, and to what extent is your inner voice and an encouraging inner voice that looks at you with unconditional positive regard, that is on your side, that treats you as somebody worth treating well and worth growing. Or, as is sometimes the case, is your inner voice a relentless, almost relentless source of negativity and criticism? That's worth some exploration, because of course we need for your own inner voice to be a constructive force rather than a destructive force. The extent to which you can become your own secure base is really what we're after.
Definitely. Okay, and then the last west point of the compass is resources. So what are those about?
This last point from the compass comes from what I find to be probably the most beautiful and profound message coming out of post-trauma growth research into what we can learn about ourselves when we go through very, very challenging times. And the post-trauma growth researchers talk about how people who've grown through trauma, have grown through very difficult transitions, often describe their growth by saying, because of that experience, I've learned that I'm more vulnerable in life than I thought. I'm more subject to the randomness of life than I thought or I wanted to be. But I realize I'm far stronger than I imagined I could be. I've realized my own strength. One of the things that I've observed in the leaders I work with, is a transition can bring about diminishment of confidence, let's call it. A transition can bring about a doubt about our own ability to cope and to succeed. And I focused on resources as the last compass point because it's really, really critical for us to remember as we're stepping into new and confusing territory that we've been there before, that all of us in our lives have gone through transitions that we've had to make sense of, and we've done it successfully. And we all have within us some skills and talents and character strengths, things that give us energy. We all have those, and they're worth remembering, even if we have to build them, even if we have to create new ones, strengthen ourselves in new ways, even if we have to, which is likely the case in a transition. Let's not forget what we already have going for us. Let's not forget our strengths and our skills. Let's remember that we've already lived through and grown through countless transitions in our lives, and we'll do the same in our leadership transitions, undoubtedly.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. Okay, so I have just one final question for you, Mike, and that would be, what would be your tip for anyone who might be listening to us today and is finding themselves in a chaotic transition? What should be the first step they should take towards finding the right direction?
I think this is a wonderful question, Thea. Thank you. Core to the practice, core to the work with leadership transitions, and core to the message of the book is leadership is, it's many things, but one thing leadership is it's the task of shaping the chaos outside of us. Our task as leaders is to shape chaos. And it's much easier to shape the chaos outside when we've taken care of the chaos inside. So my encouragement for leaders going through chaotic transitions is, when the chaos outside of you feels most confusing or unpredictable or overwhelming, remember the inside. Remember who you are. Remember what's important for you. Remember your most important values, your most important beliefs. Remember the difference you want to make. Remember what's essential to you. And if you haven't spent time articulating those things, a transition is always a good time, always a fabulous, fantastic time to start exploring those narratives or re-exploring those four narratives. So remember who you are when you're going through a chaotic transition, and get back to that work, because the more you're stable inside, the more you'll be able to deal effectively and creatively with the transition outside. I'll tell Taya, if I can, I'll tell a very quick story. I've been working with a leader of a very large business, and I started working with her a couple of years ago. And when I started working with her, she was very successful, incredibly good results, and driving the business, doing all sorts of great things. And she was, despite all the good that was going on in the outside world for her, she was deeply dissatisfied in some important ways. Part of the dissatisfaction is she felt that in order to do her work well, she needed to become somebody she didn't like very much. And we've done some good exploratory work, narrative work, over the past couple of years. And the business is in tougher circumstances. She's in tougher circumstances. There's been all sorts of chaos around her. And whereas a couple of years ago, when things were going well, she was unhappy, now that things are much more difficult for her, she's much more at peace, much more stable. Her boss, the CEO, remarked to me about how she's become kind of an example of stability and grace under pressure in the organization. And I asked her about this. I asked her about, what's your sense of what's changed in you? And her explanation was very simple and very straightforward. She said simply, "Mike, I know myself now. I know what's important to me. I know my values. I know what I can compromise and what I can't. And as long as I know those things, it's much easier to deal with things going on around me, even if those things are particularly challenging." So this task of knowing ourselves as well as we can is essential. Essential to life, essential to leadership, and really essential to leadership in transition.
Yeah, I think that's great messaging and a great tip, Mike. So thank you very much for sharing that. And of course, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of Leadership Transition and read more about your insights and findings based on psychology, or especially of post-trauma growth psychology. But thank you very much for your time today. It was a really interesting and insightful conversation for me, and hopefully for our listeners.
With pleasure, Taya. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk, and I love the territory. I hope I didn't go on too long, but I do love the territory. So you've given me an opportunity to dive into it with people, which I'm grateful for.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I've enjoyed it as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Taya.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.